in the New Testament, probably the two shortest books in the Bible. I confess I haven't checked the Old Testament prophet of Obadiah, who's very short. See what these two little books have to say to us. Well, I do like an opportunity to sing the praises of my hometown, Preston. It's many marvels and wonders. It is the origin of our motorway network. First motorway was there, the Preston Bypass. It was a crucial centre in the Industrial Revolution. Birthplace to Nick Park, creator of Wallace and Gromit, and Leo Baxendale, creator of many of the Beano's most famous characters. Slightly more questionable, it is celebrated for the brutalist architecture of its bus station. If you think the brutalist architecture is something to be celebrated. But that bus station is now grade 2 listed. I was never that impressed with it, I have to say. I remember its strange, sticky, black rubber floor more than anything. It is, of course, the home of the oldest continuously used football league ground, Deepdale. Not, of course, forgetting that Preston North End held the record for winning the FA Cup in 1889 without losing a game all season, a record that was only matched by Arsenal in 2004. But, you know, there is one aspect of Preston's history that gives me great sadness. In 1837, the first missionaries were sent to the UK from the fledgling Mormon Church, which was founded just 7 years earlier in America. You know, Mormonism is something which perhaps looks fairly similar superficially on the outside, but it is fundamentally different to Christianity. And it does not have the hope of the gospel. The first place that those missionaries went to was Preston, where one of the missionaries, Joseph Fielding, had a brother who was a minister there. And his brother invited the missionaries to preach in his church until he realized that he was very quickly losing his congregation to the Mormons. But by then it was too late, and so by September, Joseph Fielding could write in his diary that almost all of my brother James's people were baptized into the Mormon faith. Today, unsurprisingly, that church is long gone. There's now a health center standing on the site. Although it still seems to be something of a place of Mormon pilgrimage. I found it on quite a lot of Mormon websites when I was checking this out this week. It seems to me that John, the church that John wrote to in this letter was facing a similar kind of danger. We don't know much about the setting of these letters. We have to try and work it out from what we have here. It's likely that the author is the Apostle John. There's lots of similarities between these letters and the Gospel of John. The chosen lady that he writes to seems to be a way of referring to the church. Okay, a sort of poetic way of just referring to the church. Therefore, her children are the Christians there, and her sister in verse 13 will be the church that John is part of, that he's writing from. And by the time these letters are written, we are right at the end of the apostolic era, right at the end of the first century, and almost certainly John is the only apostle remaining. The rest are all dead and gone. So the question of authority would naturally be a crucial question for the churches of that day. Who can we look to know the truth after the apostles are gone? They had a unique founding role in the church, and they weren't replaced. And that's a natural question. It's not a new one. You can see it right through the New Testament letters, that there were, from the very earliest days, there were those who didn't want to accept the apostles' teaching, or those who wanted to put their own twist on it. And the letters have to combat this again and again. But perhaps at this time, with the last remaining apostle being an old man, it becomes an even more pressing issue. And there were evidently these traveling preachers who would go from city to city ministering in the churches, many of whom were sent out by the apostles or by their churches. And both of these little letters are actually to do with the question of what to do, how to respond to these preachers. In this letter, what about those other preachers who aren't sent by their churches, the preachers who are kind of freelancing, trying to win people over to their own point of view? And then in 3 John, which we'll look at next week, what to do with preachers bringing the truth when your own church leader wouldn't receive them because he loves his own status too much. But John's solution here, how to respond to these things, it is not just a bit of common sense, but it's an answer that grows out of his understanding of what we most need as Christians, what we most need, which is verse 3, right at the end there, to live in truth and love. Now that is a theme that's essential to all of John's 3 letters. He calls us to live in the truth, or warns us against abandoning the truth. In 1 John chapter 1, he speaks about it again in 3 John. Some of the traveling teachers, he says in verse 3, recently returned and made me very happy by telling me about your faithfulness and that you are living according to the truth. I could have no greater joy than to hear that my children are living the truth. So this is a central theme to everything John has to say. And here in 2 John, what he does is he sort of summarizes the dynamics for us of what this ought to look like. It's living in truth and love, and why it is so central to the Christian life. So let's look at that firstly in verses 1 to 8, and what it means to grow in truth and love and how it is that happens. You can't read the opening of John's letter and not get the point that the truth is really, really important to him, can you? Let's look at those first 4 verses. This letter is from John the Elder. I'm writing to the chosen lady and to her children whom I love in the truth, as does everyone else who knows the truth, because the truth lives in us and will be with us forever. Grace, mercy, and peace, which come from God the Father and from Jesus Christ, the Son of the Father, will continue to be with us who live in truth and love. How happy I was to meet some of your children and find them living according to the truth, just as the Father commanded. There's no missing the emphasis there, is there? No missing what's on John's heart as he's writing. The truth is to be at the heart of everything these Christians are, stand for, do, and love. But I guess that should be fairly unsurprising, really, shouldn't it? Because, after all, what you believe will shape your life. What you believe will shape how you act. It will shape the choices that you make. So to live by the truth, surely, should be crucial to everyone. Not knowing the truth or not following the truth can lead to disastrous outcomes. We've seen that again and again throughout history. In 1958, China launched a grand campaign and they killed millions and millions of sparrows. There's some of the propaganda posters calling people to do this because they thought they were pests. But with the sparrows gone, locusts and other insects just blossomed, and that led to utter devastation in the Great Chinese Famine that killed between 20 and 45 million people. So they didn't know what these sparrows were actually doing in their ecosystem. In 1988, a safety valve was removed from a pump on Pier Alpha, North Sea oil and gas platform. It was just taken out for routine maintenance. But when the next shift came on duty, that fact wasn't communicated to them. And so, in the course of their work, they turned the pump on. And in no time at all, gas was leaking out, ignited, killing 167 people, causing $3.4 billion of damage. Or when the Allies launched the D-Day attack, the Nazis' best tactician, it was Field Marshal Rommel, was at home celebrating his wife's birthday. And in fact, many of the commanders of the forces responsible for the defense of Normandy were also away for some war game exercises. Why? Because the Nazis' weather forecasting system wasn't very good. The Allies had correctly forecast that the weather would improve sufficiently on the 6th of June to make the crossing. The Nazis' forecasting said, no, no, the weather will be far too bad, we're fine. By the time Rommel and the commanders had got back, the Allies had successfully established themselves in all the 5 major landing points, and that was to be the crucial element in their victory. So you see, in each of those situations, if people had known the truth, the outcomes would have been very, very different, wouldn't they? That's why the truth must be so important to us. That's why, therefore, the Bible has to be front and center in everything that we do as a church. The teaching of the prophets and the apostles inspired by God, because we need to be people who are shaped by the truth about God, about ourselves, about the world, about eternity. That needs to be at the heart of everything. That's what John wants us to be doing. But in saying that, we need to be clear that just believing the truth in the sense of knowing that that's the truth and agreeing that that's the truth is not enough. That isn't what John ever means when he uses this word believing, which is one of his key words, certainly in his gospel. It's about believing it in such a way that my life is impacted by it, my life is changed by the fact that I believe this to be true. I act on the basis of what I say I believe. After all, James says in his letter, the demons believe in God, in the sense that they believe he exists. Doesn't do the slightest bit of good, in fact quite the opposite, because they stand all the more guilty for knowing the truth and refusing to live by it. So the truth has to be central to our lives, and it has to be impacting our lives. And so all of a sudden, John switches from the language of truth to the language of love. We are to live according to the truth, just as the Father commanded. Verse 4, what is it the Father did command? Verse 5, that we should love one another. Which sounds great, doesn't it? And who doesn't want to have that as a command for life? Love one another. Surely everyone's in favor of that, aren't they? The truth should shape us in such a way that we love one another. Jesus famously summarized the whole of God's law as you should love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and you should love your neighbor as yourself. You can take all the laws and boil them down to those 2 points of love. But we need to be clear about what this love looks like, because the problem is awareness of this truth often leads to us, I think, letting ourselves off the hook far too lightly. Because often we manage to boil it down to, well, be nice. Make it something terribly sort of wishy-washy. Be nice to people and don't do things to them that we wouldn't want done to us. But that won't do for what John is calling to us here. He won't let us sort of cop out like that. You know, as long as we take it as though we can interpret it, that we take the big thing, the big idea, love one another, as a way of saying that the rest, the details of God's commands, are unimportant, really. And so I say that, well, because I'm loving this other person, by my reckoning, God's commandments say not to lie, doesn't matter so much. So I'll lie to them rather than face up to an awkward truth. That won't do. It won't do. Say, well, I'm loving them. That's what really matters, isn't it? Not at all. In fact, there's a fascinating detail here in verse 6. Let me just tweak the translation we have here to bring it out, because you can't ever do everything in one single translation from one language to another. You'd say love means keeping God's commands, plural. That first commanding word is plural. And this is the command, the second one is singular, that we love one another. Love means keeping God's commands, and this is the command that we love one another. As though it's saying, you know, the summary of everything, love one another, means keeping all of God's commands. It means keeping all of God's commands. The most loving thing that I can do is to shape the whole of my life by God's truth. The whole of my life needs to be shaped by all that God has set, in all the various demands that puts on me, to be truthful, to be faithful, to put others before myself, to be sexually pure, to be generous, never to steal, and on we could go forming those lists. Those are the ways actually we love one another in all the various situations that we meet. Those are the hearts of what we are called to. So what those around us most need are people who will live out of the truth and who will point them to the truth in a loving way too. You see, for all the pressure that we feel sometimes perhaps to cave in to other people's expectations, doing what they would want rather than what God says is right, or for all our good intentions in choosing certain courses of action, can we really say that we're acting in a loving way if we are concealing the truth from people? Is that possible? When we're not allowing our perceptions of what's best to be shaped by the Master's handbook for humanity, are we really being loving? And I'm setting my own standards and ignoring God's? Or might the Maker know better than me? You know, it was just the other week that the chief executive of NHS England hit the headlines for laying into Gwyneth Paltrow's company, Goop, with their new series coming out on Netflix, The Goop Lab, because of all its... And he really attacked them for all their questionable claims over the health benefits some of their products. After all, he pointed out, people are naturally very, very concerned about their health. So it really matters. We tell them the truth because people could be so easily taken in by lies. And if people are led astray, well, the effects could be devastating, couldn't they? I mean, no matter how sincere Gwyneth Paltrow may be, if someone is facing really serious mental health problems, what could be the outcome if they decide to trust in psychic vampire repellent? It could be really serious, couldn't it? And in the same way, you see, how serious could the outcome be if someone goes around spreading untruths about Jesus, the only Savior, the rightful Lord of our lives? No matter how sincere they may be, how serious could those outcomes be? So we need to be those who are not only growing in truth and love ourselves, but also we need to be clear about the importance of avoiding those deadly lies, verses 7 to 11. An issue that John is particularly facing in verse 7 is teachers who deny that Jesus Christ came in a real body, it says. They denied that God the Son truly became human. And now, whatever way you try and deny that, or however you dress it up, your beliefs always end up catastrophically distant from the good news that Jesus actually brought. How and why that happens is a story for another time. But be assured it really does happen. Mormonism will be a classic example of that. So John doesn't mince his words here at all. At the end of verse 7, such a person is a deceiver and an antichrist, which is a word that simply means what it looks like it means, someone who is opposed to Jesus and undermining his mission, however kindly they may claim to talk about him. They are actually undermining and opposing all that Jesus has come to do. These false teachers didn't turn up by saying, yeah, Jesus, forget about him. They said, well, yeah, Jesus, it's just a bit different to what you thought before. What is really happening here is this. However highly they speak about Jesus, when they depart from the truth of the Bible, They are acting as an antichrist, an opponent to Christ. So John says, watch out, verse 8, so you don't lose everything. Those are the stakes that are on the table here. Don't watch out, because you could lose everything. It would be all too easy to be taken in. That's what he sees as being at stake here. Because, verse 9, anyone who wanders away from this teaching has no relationship with God. No relationship with God. Is that serious? Now, to us today, I think that very easily sounds overblown, because we feel so sure, surely, that everyone has a right to their own opinion. And if it helps them, well, you know, who am I to criticize? Should we, is it right to criticize the manufacturers of some of those goop products? Making claims that simply cannot be justified? And remember too, and just notice, we're using the language of relationship. We're saying actually, this is a real person, and I know them. Now, you know, if someone comes up to me and says, oh, I know your wife, we used to work together. That's possible, yes. But if they then go on to say, you know what, she is the only blonde French girl who grew up in Aberystwyth I've ever met. Then it doesn't matter how sincere they are, it doesn't matter how adamant they are, they don't know Sherry. Yeah? It's obvious, isn't it? And it's the same with people who have studied what the Bible has to say about Jesus, but have then decided to come up with radically different answers, or perhaps have brought their own answers and put them on top of the Bible. Needed to complete the Bible, or something like that. You know, now, I'm not talking here about Christians, perhaps, who just don't know much about what the Bible says, or were mistaken, they got a bit mixed up. You know, who are open to seeing Jesus more clearly, as you can show them from the Bible. That's not who we're talking about. We're talking about people who have seen the Bible's teaching and have twisted it, or have taken away from it, or added something else into it in order to change what it's actually saying about Jesus. It isn't loving to say, well, you know, your opinion is valid too, even though I see it differently. Because, well, they're cutting themselves off from the only Savior there is by insisting that the blonde guy from Aberystwyth or whatever it is, when there's nothing of the sort. Therefore, John is absolutely adamant that we must do nothing to encourage or to nurture false teaching that is anti-Christ, that is anti-Christian, because it leads people away from the truth, and therefore it leads them away from true love as well. Their lives will be twisted and distorted by it. So that's his concern in verses 10 and 11. If anyone comes to your meeting and does not teach the truth about Christ, don't invite that person into your home or give them any kind of encouragement. Anyone who encourages such people becomes a partner in their evil work. And we'll talk more about what that means, what it meant for those Christians, and therefore what it means for us today in Digging Deeper this week. We'll think that through a little more there. You know, the thing that I find most sobering of all about the origins of Mormonism in the UK is not that it began in Preston, sad though that is to me. It's this. The church that invited them in is a particular Baptist church. Now, that name doesn't mean anything probably to a lot of you. It's the name in old money of a Grace Baptist church. And that's the family of churches that we belong to. It was a church like ours that invited them in. I'd known that story for years. It was only this week when I sort of went and researched it a little bit, I discovered that. It's a church like ours. And yet they let in these missionaries who had a different gospel. And a huge number of the people who were there were attracted to that and were drawn away from the truth, drawn away from a relationship with Jesus, drawn away from the hope that could save them. It's a frightening expose, I think, of how shallow their belief in Jesus really was, that they should replace trust in Jesus as their only hope with a religion that's kind of self-improvement with God's help. Sure, Mormonism was a fairly new thing. They wouldn't know much about it. But it should have been pretty plain when they said, and by the way, we've got another book apart from the Bible. You need to know what this book teaches. What will you do? What will I do so that Shepherd Drive Baptist Church does not become that church? How will we grow in our grasp of and of the truth? How we grow in our depth of understanding of the truth? Because you know what? Our country is littered with empty churches that held on to the truth lightly. And so they emptied as their love declined and their distance from the real Jesus increased. Now look, we have no grounds for feeling superior to that church. But I trust that John's little letter here will spur us on to pray for ourselves and to give ourselves to know the Lord Jesus better, to get stuck into his word, to be growing in faith, in understanding, and so as that happens, to be transformed more and more into the likeness of Jesus, so that both truth and love may thrive here in a strong and a healthy church, where the living reality of a relationship with the true and living God is known. I spend a few moments just responding individually in prayer to God's words, and then we'll sing close.